The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello all, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. This show loves to talk about intersection, as in the relationship between science fiction and skepticism, or education and skepticism, or gender and skepticism. But today we'll talk about an intersection that isn't so apparent, punk music and skepticism. But there's more overlap than you'd think, especially since we'll be speaking to Nicky Garrett, guitarist for the legendary punk band, the UK Subs, who is also an outspoken skeptic. But let's start out this episode with something new. After Ontario pharmacist Scott Gavura appeared on the show a while ago, we received so many positive emails that we've given him a semi-regular segment of his own. Every month or so, you'll have the opportunity to call in and ask all the questions that you'd ask your own pharmacist, if only the line wasn't so long. Welcome back, Scott.
Hi, Des.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So Scott is the director of provincial drug reimbursement programs at Cancer Care Ontario. Prior to that, he was the director of Drug Information and Research Center at the Ontario Pharmacists Association, where he led a team of pharmacists to support appropriate drug use, deliver pharmacist education, and enhance the role of the pharmacist in the healthcare system. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Pharmacy and a Master's of Business Administration from the University of Toronto. And he's also the guy behind the science-based pharmacy blog, where he writes about pharmacy practice, questionable science, and evidence-based healthcare. So before we get to the plethora, and I mean plethora, of audience questions, Scott, tell us about your week.
I will tell you about my week. The first thing I want to add, as my usual disclaimer, Des, is that all of the opinions that I'm going to give you are mine alone. They don't represent my current employer, my past employer, any future employer. They're fine.
Perfect.
But it has been quite a week, so let me tell you about it just briefly. And it's about naturopath prescribing, and I've been writing about that on my blog since May, when an advisory council in Ontario recommended that naturopaths have the opportunity and be given the right to prescribe drugs, and was understandably concerned along with a lot of health professionals. And we wrote into government when the recommendations went into government, and when Bill 179 emerged, which was the government's interpretation of those recommendations, the naturopathy prescribing recommendation was omitted. Everything related to naturopath prescribing and an expanded scope of practice for naturopaths was omitted. So it's a good thing. We were pretty happy back in the science-based community. Mm-hmm. So. And I noted on my blog throughout the summer that the naturopaths had organized a write-in campaign. And despite that, after first reading and second reading, the bill went through unchanged. And then the bill went to hearings, public hearings. The naturopaths were well represented on those public hearings and made pleas, special pleadings, that their training required them to have access to prescribing a broad range of products, from bioidentical hormones to desiccated glands from animals to anti-infectives, antivirals, and anti-inflammatories. Mm-hmm. So all of those were part of the request by the naturopaths. And disappointingly, the standing committee made the recommendation and inserted naturopath prescribing back into Bill 179. So obviously very disappointed. I wrote about this on my blog, and I blogged about this at the Skeptic North site as well, and you know, got a bit of positive feedback, and that was it. We're trying to organize and trying to get some feedback back to government around this. But that all changed this week when the National Post picked up my blog post and printed it and put it online.
Oh my, yes.
And it exploded. There were piles of comments that poured in. I received personal and professional smears. I was likened to Hitler. I received thinly veiled threats. I was called a neocon, a Sarah Palin lover, which I think upset my family more than the reference to Hitler, actually, which was pretty surprising. So it was surprising, but the vehemence of the response was purely a function of the fact that the naturopaths could not refute the arguments that I made about naturopathy.
And you've actually also received some backup from some, actually, I would say likely sources, have you not?
Yeah, and that was actually very gratifying. There were a few letters to the editor which were actually laughable, and then there was a formal response which actually appeared, it was either yesterday or today, in the National Post from two naturopaths, and the comments have been amazing. They are, I encourage all of you to go to the National Post, you can Google my name, you can read the comments, and they are a beauty to behold. They are wonderful comments. Really from science-based advocates got on board and put in their comments and basically eviscerated the response from the naturopath. So it was a wonderful response. And there's also been blog posts written about from a number of very large U.S. blogs, including Tara Sigalata, White Coat Underground, Science-Based Medicine, the Swift blog, and JREF have all chipped in and have added their voice and their call to a call to action, really, to make the call for reason and for science known to government around Bill 179.
Wonderful. So what can people do now? Go to Skeptic North?
SkepticNorth.com. You can see the post there, which outlines the issues and provides a link so that the Premier and the Minister of Health can be contacted if you want to recognize and raise your concerns.
Wonderful. And brilliant work, Skeptic North. Very nice. So, Scott, are you ready to answer all the audience's pharmaceutical-based questions?
I am.
All right. Audience, the phone lines are open at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And if you're listening online via Ustream right now, you can discuss the show on the chat room. So the first question is, let's go with Trevor Zimmerman of Edmonton. Can you explain the differences, if any, between brand name and generic pharmaceuticals?
Well, that's a good point. The brand name product is usually brought on the market first. It usually has a patent. When the patent expires, any company can manufacture that drug. So typically what would happen is the generic company, the company that makes the generic drug, will do what are called bioequivalent studies, which basically measure how quickly and how extensively the drug is absorbed. So they'll use double-blind trial, and they will give the medication to patients, and they'll give the placebo product, and then they will give the branded product, and they will make sure that basically by measuring the blood levels that the drug is absorbed to the same extent, because it's the same active ingredient between the brand and the generic, and the belief is that as long as the drug is absorbed into the bloodstream out of the stomach, to the same extent and at the same rate, there should be no difference in the effect. So that's how generic drugs are reviewed and approved. So typically, with respect to prescription drugs, they are they're interchangeable. And that's typically what happens in the pharmacies. Once a patent expires, the brand name use of a drug will drop off almost to nothing, and generic drugs, there's four or five often, will be used in their place. So I would think for most purposes, typically with over-the-counter products as well, there should be no difference, because in order to have those generic drugs approved, they have to be compared to something, and it's usually the brand name product.
All right, next question from Fred Bremer in Vancouver. I'm hoping you can give us some insight into what pharmacists think about an issue that has bothered me for quite a while. Considering that pharmacies are an important part of our healthcare system, why are so many pharmacies selling a highly addictive, carcinogenic product that is by far the leading preventable cause of death in Canada? Is there anything pharmacists or the public can do to stop the sale of cigarettes at the same locations where healthcare professionals like yourself dispense medication to treat cancer and heart disease? Earlier this year, the Australian Skeptics wrote an open letter to their pharmacists about the sale of ear candles. They pointed out that Health Canada has banned ear candles, and then asked, what next? Will you start selling cigarettes? I'm glad pharmacies in Canada don't sell ear candles, but wouldn't those be far safer than the tobacco products that have killed over 45,000 Canadians a year, according to 1998 Health Canada numbers? Is there anything pharmacists or the public can do about this?
You know, until I saw Fred's question, I didn't realize that tobacco is still sold in pharmacies. I'm in Ontario, and from Ontario East, tobacco sales in pharmacies have been banned. But from Manitoba and on west, pharmacies still sell tobacco, which surprised me. Tobacco was pulled out of pharmacies in Ontario in 1994 because the College of Pharmacists, which is our regulator, made a formal request to government to have it removed, to have it banned, because I believe it was recognized at the time that it was unlikely that pharmacies would voluntarily remove it because of competition between stores. but by making a ban, it would basically ensure a level playing field between pharmacies. Hmm. So it surprises me that it hasn't been banned in Western Canada. So I would suggest that anybody who believes that it should be banned to approach the Provincial College of Pharmacies in your jurisdiction and ask them to take action.
And just to note, it has actually been banned for sale in pharmacies in Alberta as well.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's wonderful.
Again, the ways to reach us here are by phone at 780-492-2577, extension 1, by email at live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. From Colorado, Kiki asks, as a skeptic, I'm torn by the debate over homeopathic medicine. There are new substances discovered and derived from natural sources on a regular basis. Are we putting too much emphasis on big pharma and ignoring the possibilities emerging from herbal remedies? How do I know it isn't a conspiracy to keep money in the coffers of the second largest industry in the country?
Well, there's a lot there. Well, I don't think of homeopathy as a natural product because I don't see serial dilutions to the point of placebo as being really natural. So there's a lot there. I think that the question seems to be around prescription drugs or branded drugs versus non-branded drugs. And I think that, you know, my perspective as a pharmacist is that I recognize natural substances as having they're a tremendous source of chemicals for experimentation in terms of looking for biologically active compounds. But, you know, we've moved over time by taking natural substances, isolating their active ingredients and refining them into active pharmaceuticals. We don't have to give cancer patients bark from the Pacific yew tree. We have Taxol because we've refined it and we can manufacture it. We don't have to give, you know, willow bark to reduce fever. We have aspirin. All of the many, many products that we have as pharmaceuticals are derived from natural products. And the problem that we have when we actually use herbal products, it is very difficult to standardize the active ingredient, if the active ingredient is even known. And that's a problem in Canada, despite the Natural Health Products Directorate and the Natural Health Product Regulations. There's often very little standardization. Mm-hmm. And in the case where we have an herbal product where we don't know what the active ingredient is, there's no way to standardize that herbal product to even ensure that you know that the active ingredient that happens to be giving you the effect that you want is in there. So there's a lot of challenges around herbal products. And there's a lot of research that does go on that is not funded by big pharma. So I think that there continues to be research into that. And I think that the herbal medicines are a tremendous source of opportunity for study. But unfortunately, in terms of practical therapeutic use, there really are, you know, less than a handful of products that we can really rely on.
All right. MC in Denver, Colorado asks, how do you filter fact from speculation when researching topics, especially from online sources?
You know, it's hard. I am lucky in that I did work at a drug information center for a number of years and did develop a familiarity to use a number of great references, some of which are pay references. For example, there's an excellent reference that I use. It isn't free, unfortunately, but it's called the Natural Medicines Comprehensive Database. And it is a superb evidence-based reference that I use for researching natural health products. It is a tertiary source in that it compiles the research from the primary clinical trials. But it is a very good means of being able to access that information. You can go and look at the primary literature and look at the trials, but it's very difficult to do that, to do it in a comprehensive mm-hmm. way. So I use a mix of, you know, tertiary references, which are these credible compilations, as well as looking at the source data. So I would say for people who are doing research on their own, there's a couple of links that I'll give you. Maybe you can put it on the website later, Des. There's,
absolutely.
There's one that Tim Farley has from What's the Harm, and it's called the Skep Search. And basically, it just searches the skeptical sites, all of the skeptical sites. And it's a wonderful search engine. It's something you install on your iGoogle, your Google homepage. So I think that's a great starting point for people. I use that a lot. There's also another search bar that I use. It's called Netting the Evidence. And what it does is it searches critical appraisals of clinical trials. And it's just another one that just searches a bunch of sites and gives results. For general medical information, I use a site called Medline Plus. You may be familiar with Medline or PubMed, which is the site that you can use to search for different, basically search the medical literature. But Medline Plus is designed for consumers, and it has excellent information, and it links to credible sites. So those are all kind of ones that come to me off the top of my head. If I think of any more, I can give them to you. You can put them on the website.
Will do. Richard Murray from Toronto asks, why is it that in so many pharmacies I find so much pseudoscience on the way to the counter? even where the pharmacist might own the place, such as with many of the local chain Shoppers Drug Marts, there are copper healing bracelets, magnetic knee braces, cold effects, all sorts of ginkgo-bearing products, etc., etc., etc.
Good question. I think the short answer is it sells, mm-hmm. and I think the shorter answer is, you know, people ask for it. I think that it's, if you see a product that you don't think is credible and you don't think should be in the store, you should bring that up with the pharmacist. But I want to caution that oftentimes, depending on the store setting, the pharmacist may have little to no control over what's sold in the front of the store. Maybe a staff pharmacist in a large store where there's a front store manager, and if you ask that front store manager, why are you selling this product? They'll say, I sold 10 of them last week. So it's incumbent, I think, upon those of us who value medicine that's based on science to continually raise it as an issue and say, you know, this is a problem for me. Why are you selling this?
Well, on a related note, in a retail pharmacy setting, how much influence does the pharmacist have over what products are carried? Can she or he refuse to carry AltMed products, or are those decisions made by sales and marketing folks? Do you personally often try to dissuade customers from spending money on homeopathic products and the like? What kind of response do you get when you do?
So I guess for the first part of the question is I think I partially answered that with the control that the pharmacist has. It depends on the pharmacy setting. So I would say, well, if the pharmacist owns the store, then absolutely they can refuse to carry the AltMed products. But in some cases, it is sales and marketing decisions that may come from head office. But I think those issues should be raised if you see a product that isn't that you don't believe is science-based. With respect to my personal interactions with consumers for spending money on homeopathic products, I feel ethically that I need to tell the consumer that there is no active ingredient, and I do disclose that for when I'm in a store where homeopathic products are sold, and I will indicate that there's no active ingredient. There's no evidence that homeopathy works, although many people find that it is beneficial, but that it's almost certainly due to placebo effects.
Scott, do you often get into arguments with customers? That's
I
just
do
my
times.
Question.
I've had arguments about with patients who tell me that they manipulate their own body's pH. I just blogged about that a couple of weeks ago. So I do get involved about, you know, passionate discussions with customers, especially those that are, let's say, true believers in their particular brand of alternative therapy. And I try to keep the door open and say, listen, if you want to come and talk, I'm available to you. And I think particularly in patients that are dealing with serious diseases, it's not so much an issue because if I'm dealing with a cancer patient or a patient who just had a heart attack, they're there for the real medicine. They're not going to be taking the homeopathic remedies.
Right.
And if they do, they're taking them on the side, but they recognize that it's the medications behind the counter that are keeping them alive. It's often the worried well or the patients who are looking for just general wellness type products that they're often far more passionate in arguing that the homeopathy works because they use it in their corgi or, you know, their dachshund and things like that.
And on that note,
they've seen it work.
That's all the time we have for today. And there were actually far more questions than we had time for. So we will do this again in a month and a bit. And Scott, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to this reoccurring segment.
Thanks, Des.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye.
So you can check out Scott's writing at his blog, sciencebasedpharmacy.wordpress.com, or at the Canadian Skepticism blog he contributes to, skepticnorth.com. And we'll be right back with Nikki Garrett and Punk Rock Skepticism right after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be part of the discussion, call in every Friday from 6 to 7 Mountain Time at 780-492-2577, extension 1. That's 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can also email your questions and comments before or during the show to live@skepticallyspeaking.com or if you're on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. After the show, continue the conversation on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com or check out our Facebook group. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, why not add a review of the show? Skeptically Speaking also airs on Citywide LP 99.1 FM in Madison, Wisconsin, Public Reality Radio, WPRR 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Rosslyn 101.1 in Rosslyn, British Columbia, and on freethoughtradio.com. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. We're here with Nicky Garrett, guitarist for one of the original street punk bands, the UK Subs. Nicky is a native of Leicester, England. Besides being the original guitarist with the seminal punk band, the UK Subs, who appeared frequently on Top of the Pops in the 70s and 80s, scored several hit singles, a top 10 album, and regularly toured the globe, he has published articles in Skeptical Media, maintains a blog on skepticism at his record label's website, newredarchives.com, and frequently discusses the connection between skepticism and punk culture on TV and radio. He credits his early love of science fiction with sparking his interest in science and skepticism, and considers his first act as a skeptic to be spilling the beans about Santa Claus to his elder brother. He continues to tour with the UK Subs and also plays in Something Big, a band dedicated to the music of Burt Bacharach in his home base city of San Francisco. He is currently at work on a cookbook. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Nicky.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm pretty good.
Wonderful. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
So let's start with the obvious. When people think punk rock guitarist, it's not usually followed by thoughts of science and reason. More likely, they think of loud music in which you usually can't make out the words. But if you can, it's usually something about damn the man and everything is crap. That doesn't usually scream skeptic.
Well, it should. Because at the genesis of punk rock, skepticism was front and center. I can give you some examples of that if that would be useful to you.
Mm-hmm.
The Clash, Career Opportunities, was a song skeptical of the kind of careers that the society in England at the time thrust upon people. Some of the lyrics are, they offered me the office, they offered me the shop. They said I'd better take anything they've got. Do you want to make tea at the BBC? Do you really want to be a cop? Then there is Wire with Mr. Suit. And there's a lot of profanity in this, but I'll edit it out. I'm tired of being told what to think. I'm tired of being told what to do. I'm tired of bleeping phonies. That's right, I'm tired of you. No, 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 Mr. Suit. And it goes on, the damned anti-pope. I'm going back to the church tonight. Take me back when I was eight, but I don't mean to pray. I'm going to nick the collection plate. And it goes on. There's numerous, you could say the Sex Pistols, God Save the Queen was a skeptical statement about society at the time. So it may not be funneled into skepticism about science in particular, but it has a very, very broad umbrella, which I think 32 years ago set a lot of people with a skeptical bent off into the world.
From that perspective, I can understand that. Would you say that present day punks are as skeptical then?
Oh, it's still going, is it?
I hear.
Probably not. It seems that some of those themes have been picked up. For instance, there is still an anti-religious thing, bands like Bad Religion and various other, that seems to have been picked up. And I think it turned from skepticism to nihilism in a way. And I think a lot of the nuances got lost over the years. But certain themes are still there, anti-government. It turned from skeptical against the government to anti-government. The details have been fuzzed over a little bit, but some of the trends still continue.
Well, you've been at this a long time. So have you seen that change? I know it's fuzzy. You are a punk rock god. So have you seen that change happen from your generation to our generation? And maybe even have you seen that change in society?
I'm more of a music person and I don't write the lyrics for our band. Fortunately, I can't be held responsible for that. But I have noticed just generally that bands these days tend to take templates from older bands. And the question most commonly asked now of a band is, oh, who do you sound like? Not what are you trying to do? Not what is your message? Where are we going? But who do you sound like? And I think that is very telling as to where we are right now. And I'd like to say, I haven't really listened to punk as a punk rock fan since 1979 or something like that. I have a very broad taste in music. So I'm probably not the best expert on that, but I suppose that's why you brought me here.
So absolutely. That's a, so, well, actually, you're, like you say, you're fairly non-typical in your punkness, because you are a skeptic. You listen to classical music. You don't drink. You avoid swearing. So how did you not, I guess, how did you become a skeptic? I'd like to know how you got interested in punk.
Well, I was just looking the other day at my collection of old Skeptical Inquirer magazines, and I have them going back to the 80s that I picked up in England. So being an American magazine, I can't even remember where I found them, but it wasn't delivered to me. I found them in a bookstore somewhere, but I've got copies of Skeptical Inquirer going back into the 80s. I think the first thing that really set me on the skeptical path was Chariots of the Gods. I read the original book, and I thought it was extraordinary. Could this possibly be true? And I had the good fortune to pick up the Rational Response to that, which came out perhaps a year later, called Some Trust in Chariots. I don't know whether you're familiar with that. You can go on to Amazon.com and you can get it, even though I'm sure it's long out of print, whereas the Chariots of Gods probably still in print. But it was a scholarly response, a rational response to his claims. That was the turning point for me. And luckily, I read that book on the back of reading Chariots of the Gods. So if I was a believer in irrationality, then I was only a believer in the time it took me to go to the bookstore and find that second book. So to answer your question, that was the start of my skepticism. Punk rock fit well into that because I was of that mind prior to punk rock, and punk rock was a great cleansing. Prior to punk rock, you needed a big gold cloak and a bank of synthesizers. And there was musical skepticism about that, saying, well, do you really have to have $100,000 worth of equipment and four or five big trucks to make a good artistic statement? So in a way, there was a musical skepticality in the punk rock movement as well.
All right, now, the punks are considered to be quite left politically. And while there's obviously no inherent link between skepticism and one's political leanings, there are certain behaviors that are thought of as linked with being left, such as eating organic food, or being a vegan, or partaking in the annual detox diet, or hating big pharma. So do you talk about these things with other people in your industry?
Oh, absolutely. You can't stop me. I go nuts. Funnily enough, I noticed that I've been catching up on the back episodes of Skeptically Speaking, and I noticed, I can't remember which episode, but you did a little bit of San Francisco bashing. So not only have I got the punk community, but I've also got the San Francisco Berkeley community to deal with. So it's a double curse. And yes, I do speak up about it. I'm not a particularly political person. I don't like the arrogance of the right, and I don't like the hypocrisy of the liberals. I said to a friend of mine the other day who is very liberal, where are all of the war protests now that Barack Obama is the president? He's just increasing the troops. He's not really pulling any people out after a year. And yet here in San Francisco, everything's hunky-dory. And that's not an anti-left statement. It's just an observation. I'm not even American, so I can't vote. So.
If you have a question for Skeptical Punk Nikki Garrett of the UK Subs, you can reach us at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. So how about your fans? How do they respond to your skepticism? Because I was actually reading your skeptics page, and sometimes your fans aren't pleased with your evidence-based nature.
What, are you trying to say that I left those comments up there? What, that was that shocking.
Yes, yes, you did. Very honourable.
I've actually have a friend who is from the old days with me in a punk rock band, a well-known punk rock band, who is a moon hoax believer. And we have been knocking each other for about 4 years about this stuff. And now, of course, we have the beautiful photographic evidence, and all has gone quiet on that side of the argument. So what do they say? Well, it depends on the issue. Some of the ones that they're most ardent about are things like organic food, mm-hmm. and supplements and things like that. And I've never in my life taken a supplement. I'm not interested in organic food. It doesn't make any sense what the claims are about it. And yet, I'm a lifelong vegetarian. So again, I'm really cornered by a mass of people in the punk community, in the Bay Area community, and even from the vegetarian community who I don't generally see eye to eye to. And I think you've got to be very, very careful if you're a vegetarian about what claims you're making about vegetarianism.
Explain.
Because I'm a skeptic first, and I'm a vegetarian. That's who I am. But I don't believe vegetarianism is going to make me levitate, or it's going to make me live till I'm 140 years old.
So these kind of issues are routinely contentious?
Yeah, I think I'm in the privileged position of traveling all around the world. So it depends on what country you're in. For example, in Germany, they are very, very conspiracy orientated. The World Trade Center truthers, the Big Pharma, all of those things is very strong in Germany. When you get to other countries, perhaps Brazil there, it's often more things about religious miracles, or it really depends where you are. Australia and New Zealand have a very strong skeptic community down there, and I probably find they are the least amount of woo in Australia and New Zealand.
They've been doing some brilliant work down there. Absolutely. The skeptics down there have been getting the word out.
Yes, I go to the meetings when I'm in, particularly in Australia. I try to catch the skeptics in the pub down there if I have a day off. And I've also done quite a few radio interviews down there about which I've engineered to be about skepticism.
I didn't think they started out that way. They start out asking, I've listened to some of them, and they start out asking about your tour, and you kind of bully your way in and start talking about skepticism. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, well, I don't have to do that today, do
I? No. This is, you can talk about whatever skeptical thing you would like to. We actually have a question submitted on the website. Mm-hmm. It's not hard to find songs about disillusionment with religion, or indeed praising religion, or espousing some new agey mysticism crap, but skeptical songs seem much less common. Why do you think that is?
Education. I think that a lot of the, particularly modern bands, don't necessarily have the education to deal with those issues probably, and the information. The information's out there, but also the counter-information's out there. I think religion is very easy to be belligerent against religion, and that makes for very good lyrics. But to be belligerent against echinacea, yeah. You can be skeptical against it, but to write to have that passion against it, maybe a little bit more difficult than to have the passion about saying the Pope's decision on condoms. That's something you can fire yourself up against, and you can say, as the Damned, in one of the Damned's lyrics was, would you, no, it's actually Black Sabbath, I'm in the wrong decade, would you like to see the Pope on the end of the rope? I mean, you can get fired up about something like that, but can you get fired up about homeopathy or dowsing?
That I do understand. If you could possibly write a song about echinacea, perhaps ginkgo, I'm sure that there would be a market within this community specifically for that.
Yeah, well, there is a few people who've turned their hand at being George Frabb, mm-hmm. and who was the? I think they might be giants. Have just had a CD out about science.
Wonderful album.
I think it's coming. I think I see the gathering of the tribes after all of these years. I think that there is some momentum, and I think things may start to change. I hope so.
Again, audience, the number here is 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. So one of the other things when I was doing some research for this show, I came across a YouTube video of you. Because it seems like some people expect punks to be conspiracy theorists, and you mentioned this before. Somebody asked you about your perspective on 9/11. Do you remember that video?
Oh, you actually saw that?
I did.
I haven't seen it, but they asked me, and I spoke for quite a while saying that I believe that it was Islamic terrorists that did the damage to the World Trade Center, mm-hmm. etc. And then they kind of asked me a leading question at the end, where I think if it's the one I'm thinking of, it was at the Warped Tour.
That's the
was
one.
It, was it outside?
Yes, that's the one.
I've not seen it.
Well,
Did they edit it together?
No,
to make
no,
it
no.
Look like I was a believer.
No, and I'm actually. That's why I was kind of shocked because I'm. I guess you used very specific words, and I actually have them here. They asked, well, you specifically said, I am not a 9/11 truther. I'm actually a skeptic. However, I don't see any reason why any anomalies that are not just made-up facts shouldn't be investigated fully. And within, of course, the skeptical community, that absolutely makes sense. That's very evidence-based. But I wonder if maybe they were expecting a different answer. Maybe they took that to mean that you presumed there were anomalies?
Well, I think there were anomalies. And if they weren't anomalies, then the government aren't doing their job. Surely any government of any country would restrict certain information about the security of their country. But that doesn't lead A equals C. It doesn't mean to say that because there might be some security reasons why they perhaps misled somebody about some certain facts, that doesn't make it an inside job. It just means that some facts might be too sensitive. And it also might be that the government is incompetent. On the one hand, people say, oh, the Bush administration are incompetent and they're stupid. On the other hand, they want to have this scenario where they're basically running the world behind closed doors. I mean, which is it? You know, so
do you feel like they were looking for a different answer from you? Like,
I think they were looking for solidarity. Yes, mm-hmm. of course. And there is a lot of solidarity, particularly in Europe, within the punk movement for the 9/11 truthers. And anything like that, particularly coming out of Germany, anything that has got to do with nuclear waste or perhaps the New World Order, anything like that comes very naturally to the within the punk movement.
We have another question from the website.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite encounters with pseudoscience? Was there blood?
Well, I'm very much a pacifist, so the blood part wouldn't. Well, it could be my blood. Well, there's been so many over the years. This year, I went into one of the main in Munich, into the homeopathy center in Munich, to try to find out about a new product that's in pharmacies all over Europe, which is a homeopathic remedy that is in mainstream. There's big posters all over Germany for it. So I I thought I would play those people against the homeopathic center. So I went in and asked questions in Munich about the about what they thought of this mainstream use of homeopathy in mainstream pharmacies. And well, that I can't really go into the whole thing, but it was a very interesting conversation. They called the manager in and tried to explain why their homeopathy is of a higher level than the commercial ones.
Oh, my.
There's so many things over the years. A lot of them are after-show conversations in a dressing room, that kind of thing. But bear in mind that almost everybody in the band are also skeptics. It's not just myself. Our drummer is a skeptic, and he's got, and because he's only 25, he has a much better memory than I do, so he can back me up on some stuff.
And we have many more questions, and I know we have more emails, and we will be right back with all of them right after this.
Next week on Skeptically Speaking, we'll speak to Martin Bridgestock and Kylie Sturgis. They have recently completed one of Australia's largest surveys of paranormal, pseudoscientific, superstitious, and conspiracy theory beliefs. They've studied how age, gender, religion, and voting preference relate to belief in the paranormal, and whether there's a single underlying tendency to be a believer. Some of their conclusions are quite different from what we have seen in other studies. What does this mean for skeptical education and outreach? Find out on the next Skeptically Speaking, every Friday at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, here on CJSR.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm your host, Desiree Schell. I'm here with Nikki Garrett, a skeptic and guitarist for one of the original punk bands, the UK Subs. And this is your almost next-to-last chance to speak directly to Nikki at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or on Twitter at Skeptical Radio. I want to mention one thing. After last week's episode, I received some emails asking how people could complain to the Canadian Competition Bureau about online health fraud. So for all of you or any groups that may want to make a day of searching out, say, misleading or fraudulent Canadian cancer cure claims on the internet, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And in last week's show description, we've added the link to the online complaint form, as well as the phone number and the mailing address. And remember, you don't have to purchase the product to complain. And I actually don't think you have to be Canadian. So, Nikki, before the show, you told me a story about an experience you had that many people would presumably attribute to the paranormal. It involved cows. Oh. Can you talk about that?
Okay. I'm not quite sure if it's... Well, okay. We were in... we visited the Battle of the Little Bighorn Memorial in Montana, as we do frequently, because the singer is 65 and he forgets that he's been there, so he wants to go there every year. And we were coming away from there, and he was looking for a river to go fish in, and we found what looked at first to be a river, and it was a dry ditch type of thing, and there was a number of dead cows in there. And I wanted to find out what had killed the cows, so I made my way down into the ditch, and there didn't seem any apparent cuts or bruises or any reason why these cows should be dead. On the way back out of the ditch, going through a minefield of cow patties, I saw something that looked like a stone, but it was the same color as a cow patty, and but kind of shiny. And it turned out to be a metal, what could have been a metal meteorite. So there's a perfect story right there for some made up story about UFOs. But the good thing is I took what I thought was probably industrial waste, but it could have been a meteorite. I took it to Tam 7 and showed it to Phil Plate, and he subsequently, it's now in the laboratory being tested. I think it's looking less and less likely to be a meteorite. So if we'd have stopped right there and I just kept it in my closet, it would have been perfect for some of the UFO believers. But you see, to carry on and test it and find out what it is what skepticism's all about.
Well, I find this interesting because, you know, even I'm a skeptic, but I have to admit I read a lot of science fiction. And if I walked into a field where there were a whole bunch of dead cows, I would think non-skeptical thoughts initially. I definitely would. Did you not?
I
have to call Phil Plate.
Well, any excuse to talk to Phil Plate, but I've got a question for you, though, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to one of the past episodes, and you had Paul Ingram on.
Absolutely.
There.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was listening to him, and he seems a nice chap, and he seems fairly sincere, and he's saying, "Oh, I only interested in things that work, and they should be tested." And I don't remember his exact words, but at the end of it, I was thinking, "Well, why doesn't he become a doctor then? Why is he an alternative medicine? Because everything he said is what you do if you're a researcher or a doctor."
That's a very good question. I hope that Paul listens to this episode, because I would love to know the answer to that. But I do have to say, I'm very pleased that Paul is a registered massage therapist, because there are many fields that are very, very much not science-based.
Right.
And we need all the people that are science-based to get into those fields and maybe bring some evidence and some proof and reason and logic and all that lovely sciencey goodness.
Well, I suppose that massage is not really all the way in the pseudoscience field, is it?
I don't know. I think it depends on the practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm sure that there are other people like Paul, and I know for a fact after that episode, I spoke to a few other registered massage therapists who share the same kind of perspective as Paul does. But there's a lot that I'm assuming they think they can cure your cancer or your MS or prevent malaria or, you know, the same thing that any homeopath would say.
Look out for the mustache. If they've got a weird mustache that's kind of a strange shape, that's usually a sign.
Really? There's a connection there?
I don't know.
I think we should do a study.
I just know on our local market, there's a chiropractor, on the local farmer's market, there's a chiropractor who has a mustache that's sharp as a needle and sticks straight out to either side for about 6 inches.
Really? So. He has a handlebar mustache and he's
no,
a massage?
It's not a handlebar. It's straight out. Anyway, we're getting off subject.
I have to say that would not fill me with feelings of security and comfort if that man was touching me. That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
So do you, in your spare time, your copious amount of spare time, do you do a lot of research about skepticism?
Only on particular subjects, because I'm a great devourer of skeptical videos, and I love to listen to the Daniel Dennett and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and all those people and take it in. That's not research, that's enjoyment. When it comes to a particular topic that I need to learn more about, I will do that. But bearing in mind that I am a musician who is a supporter of skepticism, and I'm not a professional physicist, and my message is always go to the expert. Don't come to me or Jenny McCarthy or anybody else. Go to the people who know what they're who have studied all of the intricacies of the subject and know what they're talking about. So I mostly do research to support my own understanding of a subject.
Perfect. That's possibly the best reason. We also have another email from the website.
Question is, have you ever been to one of the big skeptical conferences? If not, do you plan to?
I go to TAM each year. because that's my only holiday is 4 days in Las Vegas. And I really enjoy that because I feel in a way that it's my chance to be around other like-minded people. And there is no other opportunity to immerse yourself in rational thinking. So I do TAM. I go to the Bay Area Skeptics in the pub when I'm in town, and I go to various ones around the world if I happen to have a day off. I play table tennis a lot, so on my days off I either go to play table tennis or I go to a skeptics meeting, and that's my life on the road. So I get to go to skeptics meetings a lot in Australia, but I also play a lot of table tennis in Australia and New Zealand and wherever I am. So
What I find very interesting is that you definitely don't promote yourself as anyone famous while you're there, because I attended the amazing meeting this year, and I had no idea that you were there until you mentioned it to me.
You didn't notice all the women screaming?
I must have missed that part.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, yeah. Occupied.
Well, why should I? At TAM 7, I'm not anybody special. Actually, I think we talked a little bit about the feminist angle of TAM. And one thing I take offense at is that because you're a woman, you should be there on stage at TAM 7. Well, if you're a woman who's got something appropriate to say, like, you know, Jeannie Scott or somebody like that, they've got every right to be there, just as much right as any man to be there. But I shouldn't be up on stage at TAM. What's my expertise? I'm talking to you on this interview because you're looking for the connection between some sort of popular culture and skepticism. And I have a unique perspective on that. That doesn't make me an expert on physics or evolutionary biology, and I shouldn't be on the stage at TAM.
Well, but this, I guess, the part that I find so interesting is, if you were there and you're famous, what other famous people are incognito going to skeptics meetings that we should know about? Do you know any of them?
Do you know what? That's a very good question. I as far as outside of the people in my band, I don't really personally know too many people. It's not that they're not skeptical. It's that they perhaps don't give it the priority that I do in my life. So I don't know. Maybe I've got acquaintances in the music business. I'm not much of what we call in England a ligger. A ligger is somebody who just hangs around famous people to try and have some of that fame rubbed off on them. I mean, we toured with the Ramones in the 80s. We've played with various other of the big bands. I think we might be going out with Motorhead soon. We've toured with the Misfits. I'm not the kind of person who just hangs around with the stars to... Now, if it was Richard Dawkins, I would be, you know, maybe I would think differently. But
I think the reason why I ask is because we need more people that are in the public eye in any way to speak out on behalf of science and skepticism. You can use your powers for good, sir.
Well, I think I do that. I make it clear.
Definitely.
You know, one of the things I think that's important is that Dawkins talks about this, about religion, that they get a free pass and people don't call them on it. And I think that can be extended all the way over to all types of skepticism, that you don't just accept what people say and go, well, that's their belief. That you do speak up and say, well, I don't actually think you're right on that. You don't have to be a bully and you don't have to be a bore. For me, that's just purely coincidental. But you have to, you know, make it known that, no, I'm not a foot soldier for the homeopathy people. I'm not going to just believe this stuff because lots of other people do believe it. Yeah, I have to let people know that there is a contrary train of thought out there, and I do that.
And it's not just a contrary train of thought. It's a contrary train of thought that happens to have evidence behind it.
Yeah, well, I really did understate that. It, you know, there are people who want to be rational and want to think rationally, not just go with the flow. Sometimes people ask me, well, why do you care what I believe? Why does it bother you that I think that echinacea it works or not? And I think that it's a very liberating thing to be a skeptic, because if I found out, if there was some new evidence that they found out that echinacea really was good for something, then I would be wrong. I would change my position on that. And that's very liberating. If you have Jesus tattooed all over your body and the cross and everything, it's not so easy to get rid of it. But if you carry your, I'm talking metaphorically there, if you ingrain your beliefs in your brain as though they're a tattoo, then it's very hard to get rid of them. But as a skeptic, we don't have to do that. We don't have to ingrain our beliefs so firmly in our brain that there's no possibility of change.
Absolutely agreed. And that's our time. Thanks so much for being here, Nikki.
Well, I really enjoyed it, and that can't possibly be our time, but I'll have to take your word for it, because you've got all the equipment over there.
the clock says now. So if you want to know more about the UK subs, visit uksubs.co.uk. And if you want to check out Nikki's writing, head to newredarchives.com, click NRA Zine, and scroll down to the Skeptics page. And you can find our website and the comment section for this episode at skepticallyspeaking.com, as well as the links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to iTunes, where you can download the show, or if you are so inclined, you can write a review. And remember, quickly, you have until the end of the year to submit a new theme song for the show. We are accepting original, CD-quality, 60-second compositions, for which you will receive nothing but our eternal gratitude. Please and thank you. Hint, hint, Nikki. Closing today's episode now. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Never see, and everything you believe. who's alive.
Dinosaurs were invented by God as a test. Our bodies don't rot when we die. Oh, the hippies are working for the government.